All right, counsel, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is A220519 Terrell versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, this is our fifth of five arguments this morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd ask that you state your name and your client's name, pronouncing both for us, and identify how you would like us to address you this morning. And with that, the appellant may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Michael McLaughlin, and I'm an attorney from the State Public Defender's Office, and I'm representing the appellant in this case, Patrick Terrell. This case presents two issues. The first is whether the district court committed reversible error by denying Mr. Terrell his right to testify at the probation revocation hearing. And the second issue is whether the district court's revocation of probation was an abuse of discretion because the court failed to conduct the required analysis before revoking probation and because the court revoked probation primarily based on Mr. Terrell's homelessness. I'm going to begin the argument today with the first issue and then turn to the second issue after that. The state concedes several important aspects of our argument regarding the denial of the right to counsel. The state concedes that Mr. Terrell had a right to testify at that probation revocation hearing, and he had a right to testify specifically on the issue of whether his violation from the halfway house was unintentional or inexcusable. The state further concedes and agrees that the district court violated that right to testify when it stopped Mr. Terrell from testifying about the circumstances of his termination from the halfway house and directed him to direct his testimony to the third Austin factor. And the state also concedes that that error was structural error. My understanding, and I know the when the state argues this case today, they can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding of their brief is they're conceding a structural error, but they're asserting that plain error review applies to it nonetheless because it wasn't preserved, it wasn't objected to in district court. So I believe the state's position is it is structural error, but nonetheless it's not reversible plain error, and that's really the issue that's disputed today between the parties on this issue is whether the failure of the court to honor Mr. Terrell's right to testify was reversible plain error.
So appellant's position, though, is that plain error is applicable, whether it's a structural error or not. Or what is your position? I guess I could
The state's
it.
Position is that plain error is...
More open-ended here.
The state's position is that plain error does apply to it, even though it's structural. Our position is that, for several reasons, plain error does not apply to Mr. Terrell's case. The first reason is one that's factual to Mr. Terrell's case, and that is that he did assert his right to testify in district court. The plain error doctrine only applies where a probationer failed to assert the right in district court, and that's what the Supreme Court said in State versus Bolio. That's the standard that causes someone to forfeit a constitutional right and triggers plain error analysis.
But there wasn't an objection. You're just saying his words, "I'll testify," and then the sections of the court's response at various points is, "Well, I think I've already decided this. Why don't you move along?" That's the preservation of the issue in the record. Okay.
That's our position. Yeah. And Bolio talks about an assertion of the right. And here there was an assertion. He said, "I'll testify." And then in response to his attorney's questions, he specifically said that he could testify toward the, he would testify regarding some of the statements the probation officer made about the grounds for his termination from Damascus Way, and he would also testify about the reliability of the information that the probation officer relied upon during his testimony. At that point, the district court interrupted and said, I've already decided that this was a violation. I want you just to direct your testimony to the third Austin factor. Our position is that that was an assertion of his right, and then there was an adverse ruling in response to his assertion of the right by the court saying that he couldn't testify to that issue.
But, I mean, he eventually did get to testify, you know, as to the intention. And, I mean, he did then say, I would do what I was supposed to do. I was going to work. I was coming back. I was complying to the best of my ability. He said he stopped drinking, denied he had falsely signed out of Damascus Way, or viewed pornography on his cell phone. I mean, so no matter what the court said it was going to do, he was able to kind of talk about whether these were, you know, to the substance of the violations. In fact, he kind of denied some of them.
Right.
I mean, so it's kind of like, okay, you know, I mean, the court heard it, made credibility determinations, off you go.
And I think, I understand your point on that.
I mean,
that.
If he didn't say those things, I'd say you've got a stronger argument that, you know, he wanted to talk and you didn't let him talk, that's a problem. But he talked anyway about some of the things he now says he wanted to talk about. So I'm at a loss to understand how that's structural error when he did get to testify about some of these things.
So I would just note first that the timing of that was he made those statements earlier in the hearing before his subsequent assertion of the right to testify. So procedurally, it was a little bit unusual the way this played out.
Was he under oath?
He... I'm not entirely sure on that. I believe he was under oath.
And he was on the stand. So it's not like, you know, he's sitting next to you yakking at me. He's on the stand talking about what he wants to talk about. I mean, I agree, that'd be different.
Well, and I think, he made those statements initially when the plan was for this to move forward through an admission. There was going to be an admission, and then the parties were just going to argue over the third Austin factor. And then in the course of his admission, he started, you know, essentially disputing a lot of the state's claims regarding why he was terminated from Damascus Way. And then at that point, the court and the parties agreed to convert it from an uncontested hearing on the first Austin factors to a contested hearing. So he did make statements relating to the circumstances of his termination, but that was before he asserted his right to testify, and it was during the stage of the proceedings when it was not yet a contested hearing.
But, I mean, the district court doesn't forget all of the things that it's already heard up until the time that it makes a decision that there's been an intentional and an inexcusable violation of a probationary condition. I mean, we can't bifurcate the hearing. You're not arguing that we bifurcate the hearing in that way.
No, but I think he's – so he'd already said – he said his stuff initially. But after that, in response to his attorney's questions about the probation officer's testimony, which happened after his initial statement – he said he had more to say. He said he wanted to, you know, dispute what the probation officer had just said, and he wanted to attack the reliability of the information the probation officer was relying upon. Those are two issues that moved beyond what he'd previously said about his termination from Damascus Way, and he had more that he wanted to testify to. He had more that he wanted to say about it.
So, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Okay. The district court did say, any more questions for appellant? And the response was no. So structural error at that point? I mean, they sat down and said, nope, we're done. I mean, what should we do with that?
Well, we'd argue that there was, the court did give the defense an opportunity to respond during its, before its analysis of the second Austin factor, and the defense didn't say anything else to add at that point. But our position would be that after that, Mr. Trail still asserted that he wanted to testify. And then in response to his attorney's questions, he stated that he wanted to testify about the probation officer's testimony regarding his termination from Damascus Way. So it would have been... the preservation, you know, would have been more perfect, would have been clear if throughout defense counsel had said we're objecting to this. But given that the right to testify is a personal one, that the defendant has to personally waive, here we have the Mr. Terrell expressly saying he wanted to testify about these issues, and the district court didn't let him give that testimony when he had more to add about his termination from Damascus Way beyond what he already stated. That is our position, that is a violation of his right to testify. And that and the right to testify in Rosillo was classified as a structural error. A lot of the issues about what he'd already said, to me, that would go more to prejudice. That would go to whether the court's denial of his right to testify was prejudicial. But the Supreme Court has stated that because the right to testify is a structural error, it's not subject to prejudice analysis. It's not subject to harmless error analysis.
But then what do we do with Polzinski and State v. Bay? Because it seems like the Supreme Court is going in a little different direction.
So to begin with, I'd ask this court to start its analysis with Rosillo, which dealt with the specific right at issue here, the right to testify. And in that case, the court found the right to testify to be a structural error. It classified it with complete denial of right to counsel, denial of an impartial judge. And in that case, the attorney did not object to the violation of the defendant's right, right to testify. But the court still found that that it was error that would require reversal, even though the attorney did not object. Polzinski adopted a different rule, but the court was very careful to limit it to the specific right at issue, and in that case, it was the right to a public trial. And Polzinski, in footnote 9 of that opinion, expressly stated, we're not making any judgment about whether plain error applies to other structural errors. We're only holding that based on the particular characteristics of the right to public trial, that plain error analysis should apply where a defendant fails to object to a violation of the right to public trial. And I think in Bay, the court's discussion of Polzinski and this issue was in dicta, first because the court found that the error wasn't structural. And so I don't know if Bay adds a whole lot to the analysis, but to the extent it does, it only sort of repeated Polzinski's holding regarding the right to public trial, and Bay didn't make any broader holding beyond that. From Polzinski, the rule the Supreme Court seems to be following now is it's going to look at structural errors on a case-by-case basis, apparently, or at least it's going to leave open the possibility that some structural errors are subject to plain error review. But again, in Rosillo, the court did look at the particular error at issue here of the right to testify, and it found that that was a structural error that that was provided a basis for reversal, even though the defendant did not, the defense counsel did not object to it in district court. So we'd ask that Rosillo is the authority here, and Polzinski, although it leaves open some questions about how the Supreme Court's going to move forward with how it treats structural error and plain error analysis. It doesn't do anything to overrule Rosillo. It doesn't really apply to the specific issue here in this case. One other thing about Polzinski is the court made a point of talking about how the right to public trial is a qualified right, and it distinguished it from other fundamental rights, and that it recognized that in situations, courts have found that the public right to public trial can be adjusted and accommodated to meet competing interests. The right to testify is of a fundamentally different character. That's been repeatedly stated to be an essential element of due process, an essential part of the adversarial system in general, the defendant's right to be heard, the defendant's right to present his or her side of the story. That's sort of the most basic aspect of the criminal adjudicative process. So our position would be there's a good reason to treat the right to public trial differently from how to treat the right to testify, and that Rosillo looked specifically at the right to testify, found it was a structural error, found it was a structural error that required reversal, even though defense counsel did not challenge it in district court. We ask the court to follow that. And then I'll get into my second argument in rebuttal, but just briefly, it's our position that even if plain error does apply here, that that the state is not the plain error should not preclude this court from reversing, or that this court should reverse under the plain error standard. The state concedes the first three elements of plain error met here, so the only dispute is whether if this court did not reverse, if it would cause the public to question the integrity and fairness of the judicial system. Again, just what I said about the nature of the right to testify, it's basic to the adversarial process. So if this court allowed the error to stand where a probationer was not allowed to give facts that he found relevant to why he violated probation, that is the type of error that would cause the public to question whether there was a fair process here and whether both sides were given a fair opportunity to present their side.
All right, thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel?
Good afternoon. I think we're into the afternoon at this point. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Megan Lindsay. I'm a certified student attorney. I'm a third-year law student at the University of St. Thomas. And I am here today on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota.
Could you speak up, Ms. Lindsay?
Of course. I will try. I would just like to briefly highlight three points I'm hoping to make today. The first does go specifically to appellant's first argument as well. It's undisputed that this record contains irregularities. However, the record does not support appellant's assertion that Mr. Terrell was denied the right to testify. He was not denied nor barred from testifying. He did testify. His testimony consisted of 119 lines of that 39-page court transcript.
The question, counsel, really is he's claiming that he was denied the opportunity to testify about the thing that he wanted to testify about.
Correct.
And do you agree that he was denied that opportunity?
I don't agree with that assertion,
All
no.
Right. Why don't you explain why?
Of course. So throughout the court transcript, we see time and again the court attempting to protect the rights of Mr. Terrell. So this, as pointed out by appellant counsel, this trial, this hearing, started out as just a run-of-the-mill, very basic admission hearing. So all parties went into that courtroom that day fully intending for Mr. Terrell to admit to that violation. Things did take a turn at a certain point around page 9 to 11 of your transcript, and Mr. Terrell faltered, and the court saw fit at that point, in order to protect his constitutional rights, to not accept an admission when he truly didn't believe that he was guilty of something, to pivot and to kind of transition into a contested revocation hearing. So in that regard, his rights were protected and were not denied.
Well, those rights were protected and not denied.
Certainly.
I mean, his claim now is that I only gave you part of the story about why I was discharged from this program, and I want to give you the full story, and you're not letting me do that.
Certainly.
So where in the record are you claiming that he was given the opportunity to say all the reasons why he wasn't intentionally violating that condition of his probation?
Sure. So I think Judge Connolly made a very good argument earlier, and I agree with his assertion
Statement. I'm making a statement.
Yes, thank you. Appreciate that.
Not trying to be favorable to one side or the other.
So I agree with that statement that even though the judge did suggest that Mr. Terrell limit that additional testimony to the third Austin factor, Mr. Terrell, in fact, still provided some content, some context and some testimony regarding the second Austin factor. And further, I mean, it's the state's position that this is why the forfeiture doctrine applies, that if Mr. Terrell truly intended to testify further on that second Austin factor, then he should have raised his hand or alerted his attorney, or his attorney could have spoken up for him and made the court aware that it was his desire to continue testifying about that second Austin factor.
And why was it insufficient why is it not the same thing when he says, I want to tell you some more stuff about why I was kicked out of this program? Why isn't that enough for him to preserve his right?
Particularly with the court cutting him off, saying, I'm sorry, I've already made findings on that. Move on to this other thing.
Sure. I think it harkens back to the idea that we can't separate that the first nine pages of testimony from the latter part of the testimony. I mean, the judge had already heard information regarding, I mean, Mr. Terrell admitted to the violation and provided context as to that admission. So the judge was already working with that knowledge at that point. Does that answer your question?
In part.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think there's any dispute that he was admitting that he was discharged from the program. The question is whether his discharge from the program was an intentional and inexcusable violation of his probation. And the way I read the appellant's brief is he wanted to provide some flavor as to why his departure from the program actually happened.
Sure, sure. And I definitely understand the point that you're both making as to, you know, why were his words not enough, essentially, to preserve that for appeal. I think going back to my previous argument, I think the judge had enough information at that point to make a decision. That's what she believed at that point. And I think this hearing was messy. I mean, it got off track. It wasn't a by the book, stick to the script kind of hearing. And I think it's reasonable to understand that omissions, oversights, errors can be made in that kind of an environment.
Well, you know, here in Ramsey County, we were always perfect.
Understood. I did not know that.
As a former Ramsey County judge, I can attest that we are not always perfect, but we try.
Well,
at the end of the day, I mean, Ms. Lindsay, look, I mean, he wanted to say some more things about why he violated, you know, the reasons for his intentional violations. But, I mean, at some point, it's like, you know, I mean, I'm not drinking anymore. Well, you know, good for you. You're not supposed to ever drink in Damascus way. So, I mean, I guess I don't, we should always let defendants say whatever they want to say. But here, I'm not so sure, speaking for myself only, that, you know, he didn't sort of get to say enough of what he wanted to say. Maybe he wanted to say some more stuff, but I'm not so sure that anything he said would have changed whether this was an intentional violation or not, particularly considering this was his third time at bat.
I definitely agree with you.
And then, I mean, was there testimony from the other side, the probation officer, because now he's saying, I wasn't looking at pornography. I mean, was there testimony from the probation officer or whoever that, you know, his cell phone had porn on it?
There was testimony to that fact, yes. And
going
off of that, I do certainly believe that the record contained enough information at that point for the trial court judge, Judge Hain, to make a decision. And I don't think that the precedent that we have been told to follow is that judges are to recite line and verse, you know, from prior cases or from prior case law. I think the trial court judge was doing the best she could in making sure that the record was full and accurate. And, you know, it's the state's position that in this situation, Mr. Terrell's counsel at that hearing should have spoken up if he intended to say anything further about that second Austin factor.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, what's your response to appellant counsel's argument that the waiver of the right to testify is a personal right? So the lawyer can sit on his or her hands. It doesn't matter if the defendant wants to testify, he gets to exercise that right.
Absolutely. I don't dispute Rosillo or any case law that's followed after Rosillo. Along those lines. When the district court suggested that Mr. Terrell limit the balance of his testimony to that third Austin factor, Mr. Terrell's response was not, but I would like to continue testifying. It was, I'm sorry, I believe. He apologized to the court and then redirected his testimony to the third Austin factor with some other details sprinkled
in.
So
that's a waiver? When the judge tells you, stop talking about this? You can only talk about that now?
I do think it's a waiver in sorts. I mean, one case specifically that we cited in our brief was...
I wouldn't exactly call that a voluntary relinquishment of his rights when the judge directs.
But we can move. You can move on to the rest.
No, I'm happy to continue answering questions.
Go ahead.
Okay. I was. 1 second, please.
Can I just ask a point of clarification?
Sure.
I think we've exhausted this particular issue, but counsel is characterizing your argument as one of conceding that this is a structural error, and I just went back and looked through your brief, and I don't see that in your brief. Are you claiming that this error is analyzed under the plain error test, or are you conceding that it is a structural error?
We do not concede that it's a structural error, contrary to appellant counsel's assertion. Obviously, if we believe that Mr. Terrell was denied his right to testify, case law tells us that would be a structural error, and he would be entitled to remand or automatic reversal. That's not the facts that we have here in the state's opinion, though. We don't see within the confines of this transcript that Mr. Terrell was truly denied that right to testify.
So under the plain error analysis, and you've conceded the first three elements of that analysis, when we get to whether the denial of the right affected the fairness and the integrity of the proceedings, where is the line drawn as far as how much testimony has to come in so that we can be assured that the fairness and the integrity of the proceedings was not affected by the judge's decision to say, I've heard enough? What's the legal line for the I've had enough?
I don't know that we have one. I don't know that that's been plainly or clearly laid out in case law for us. But I'm going to go back to the first part of your question because I think that was very interesting. In our brief, and I'm certainly cautious to argue contrary to our brief, but I think in following the precedent from Polzinski and kind of following their lead of how that opinion was laid out, we perhaps too quickly glossed over those three factors of the plain error doctrine. And I'm not sure at this point if it's really prudent for us to concede that third prong of the plain error doctrine.
What did the state concede, if anything, in its briefing to this case?
So, Your Honor, we made the comment that to the satisfaction of the state, I believe was our exact wording. All three of those prongs had been satisfied, and then we proceeded on to the fourth prong. So I would just, along that line of that third prong, I guess I would ask this court to make an independent judgment regarding that third prong, notwithstanding our concession within the brief. State v. Bay gave us some very helpful language, that Minnesota Supreme Court case from 3 months ago tomorrow, I believe. And Bay said, when analyzing whether an error affects a party's substantial rights, the issue is whether a reasonable possibility that a reasonable trier of fact may have reached a different verdict for the error. And I think the answer to that here is no. I don't believe that the trial court judge, if she had had the opportunity or if she had heard additional testimony from Mr. Terrell on that second Austin factor, I don't believe she would have reached a different opinion.
Could you touch upon, Ms. Lindsay, the second part of Mr. McLaughlin's argument, the homelessness issue?
Of course. I mean, the state finds no support in the assertion that Mr. Terrell's probation was revoked plainly because he was experiencing or would be experiencing homelessness. There's a very clear record that Mr. Terrell pled guilty to and was convicted of fourth-degree criminal sexual conduct. He was placed on probation for 10 years. He had two violations and two sanctions conferences in every 3 to 4 months during those, 2 years that he had served on probation. One of the very necessary components or conditions of probation was that he remain in safe, secure, supervised housing, and that's what Damascus Way provided. Time and again, he showed that he wasn't serious about complying with the conditions of his probation, and he was eventually kicked out of Damascus Way for his inability or his unwillingness to comply with those conditions. Nowhere in the transcript, nowhere in the conditions that were ordered by the court for his probation was there a requirement that he maintain a certain level of income or anything regarding his status as an indigent individual. So the assertion that he was sent to prison because he was homeless is simply wrong. He had committed a crime that posed a threat to the community, and in order to kind of counter that risk to the community, he was told that he needed to remain in safe, supervised housing, and he didn't do so. So through his own actions, he created a condition where there were no longer suitable housing options available to him. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Thank you very much.
Of course. Does the court have any further questions?
Any other questions from the panel? Seeing none, counsel.
Okay, thank you all so much. And just quickly in summation, the state reasserts that Mr. Terrell was not denied his right to testify at that probation revocation hearing. We assert that the forfeiture doctrine applies because Mr. Terrell nor his counsel raised their hand or interjected when the court asked him to limit subsequent testimony to that third Austin factor. Going back to your point, Judge Frisch, the district court's error doesn't call into question the fairness, integrity, or judicial reputation. And for those reasons, the state submits that appellant is not entitled to appellate relief.
Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I have a question to start us off. Okay. And this is a question that I've had from the beginning that I didn't ask the first round, but I'll ask it now. What else did he want to tell the district court judge that he was not able to tell her?
Well, what he stated on the record was he was disputing the source of his probation officer's testimony. The probation officer testified that he essentially spoke to people at Damascus Way. And so apparently Mr. Terrell was attacking the reliability of the people he talked to at Damascus Way. So I think he...
But that was communicated to the district court judge. So what was not communicated to the district court judge that the district court judge denied him the opportunity to inform her?
I don't know. Well, I don't know if that was exactly communicated. Again, it's unclear because he wasn't given the right to testify, so we don't know exactly what he would have said, and we're really trying to,
That would help me understand whether the denial of his right to testify affected the fairness and integrity of the proceedings, because if the district court was fully informed of all the things that he wanted to say, then it's difficult to reach a conclusion that there's something that makes this proceeding unfair.
So I would just make the point that Polzinski emphasized that fairness and integrity prong doesn't look at the individual case. It doesn't look at the individual defendant and the prejudice to the defendant. It looks at how the public would react to that error going uncorrected. So I think the questions you're asking don't really go towards that fairness and integrity prong. They go to the third prong, whether it would affect his substantial rights. I know the state... Just if I turn a little bit to some of the stuff the state said.
Of course.
They did concede that the third prong was met here in their brief. So we'd ask the court not to accept that argument for this reason at this stage because we didn't have an opportunity to respond to it in our reply brief. But from my recollection of Polzinski, it made the point that structural errors are defects in the entire process, so the whole adjudicative process. So the third prong really presupposes that there was an adversarial process, and then it looks to whether the defendant was prejudiced by an error that occurred during that process. But the third prong, at least there's language in Polzinski that suggests that the third prong doesn't even apply when you're looking at structural errors, and that really plain error review for structural errors is limited to that fourth prong, and that's the only way that a structural error can be found to be not plain error is if it doesn't meet the fourth prong. So again, I can't go into detail on that because I wasn't prepared, but I would just ask the court to review Polzinski again if it does consider that third prong argument. So Just briefly again, the it does, you know, the state said this was a messy process and that, you know, we should just sort of accept that things didn't run perfectly. I would just point out that when it comes to fundamental rights, this court has always been strict, both regarding the waiver requirements and just the court honoring an invocation of a fundamental right. So although, you know, there is leeway in certain things with the way these hearings are run, when it comes to a basic like the right to testify, the court really does need to do that correctly, and that did not happen in this case, would be our position. And just turning, and we'd also just ask, regarding whether the state conceded that an error occurred, I would just ask the court to review pages 2 to 3 of their brief, where the state says it concedes the district court erred by forgetting to ask Terrell if he wished to offer additional testimony, and the state says that this error was not cured during Terrell's subsequent testimony when the district court essentially limited the scope of Terrell's testimony as to whether or not he should go to prison. And then the state proceeded to cite cases that say that a denial of the right to testify is structural, and then it got into his Polzinski argument, which is about a structural error. So that was the basis for us saying that the state did concede that this was a structural error. And then briefly, so we argue abuse of discretion occurred in this case regarding the probation revocation in two ways. The court didn't look at the three sub-factors that are outlined in Motland before revoking probation, and instead the court relied on what we view as an impermissible reason to revoke probation, and that is the fact that Mr. Terrell was homeless at the time of the hearing and did not have suitable housing available. Relied primarily on Bearden for that argument. I'd ask the court to look at that argument again in our brief. But the basic point was that the sub-factors, and I'll try to be real brief here, the sub-factors are designed to lead a court to conduct the analysis that ensures that revocation is reserved for situations where treatment has failed and incarceration is a necessary last resort. And those factors are designed to ensure that happens. Here, the court didn't look at that. And if it would have, it would have reached the conclusion that intermediate sanctions were the appropriate response here. If it had concerns about his
lack... Even though this was his third time.
Even though it was his third time.
Prior violations involved him being discharged from treatment, engaging in sexual misconduct at employment, and then this, you know, not following the most basic rules so that he wouldn't be homeless. I mean, he's...
No, and I understand that point. I mean, and he does bear some responsibility for losing his housing, but it...
He bears still all the responsibility for losing his housing. Whose fault is it, not your client's?
Well, I'd respond that he didn't get a chance to describe fully why it wasn't his fault, and that's part of what happened in the case. But the issue is... Probation officer and the court both agreed that essentially if he had suitable housing, he would stay in the community and he wouldn't be revoked.
And he had suitable housing, which he lost by failing to follow the rules. And I mean, they were not going to just, I mean, is your argument the judge should have said, well, you know, do the best you can on the streets?
Our argument is that he should have imposed an intermediate sanction, keep him in custody until housing became available.
Was there any indication in the record that he could have said, hey, I've got enough money, I could be at some group home somewhere. Was there anything like that in the record? Like, hey, there's an alternative, I've got some place to live, I can go with my sister, blah, blah, blah.
He stated on the record that he had an apartment available that wasn't going to become available in a couple of weeks. It hadn't been investigated yet by the officer, but he did state that he could have private housing become available in the future. But I think, essentially, the court didn't look at the option of intermediate sanction here. And that was a failure to exercise discretion to consider intermediate sanctions. This court stated that courts should consider intermediate sanctions if it's a situation where someone can still be rehabilitated and revocation is not necessary. And the court didn't exercise its discretion here by considering that option.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you very much, everyone. The matter is submitted. Thank you for your submissions. They were very well done. And we will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within 90 days. And that concludes our calendar. And we are in recess.